Hi and welcome back to the shortest history of Britain. In this episode, we're going to be diving into the 1300s. And what a ride. What a century of events it was. As was customary, there was war from end to end. Ours was rarely a peaceful place to live. But the times were changing. The society we live in now was beginning to take root in some of the developments we see from back in the 14th century. And the country was starting to shape into one we better recognise. So without further ado, let's dive right in. When we left the 13th century, Edward I, the king, had just invaded Scotland, overthrown the leader, and taken their cherished coronation stone back with him to Westminster. When he left the country in 1296, he believed that the conquest of Scotland was complete. But we know, if we study even a day of the Middle Ages, that no such assumption could be made for long. The resistance sprung up immediately in the form of two great Scottish knights. Andrew de Moray led the uprising in the north of the land, and William Wallace led the revolution in the south. De Moray's force, a gathered band of men from across the land operating in guerrilla warfare tactics, overthrew the English occupation of the land. They raided each of the English garrisons from coast to coast, routing the English there before heading south to the borderlands. The following year, so in 1297, the raid on the garrison at Lanark by William Wallace and his men led to the killing of the English sheriff there, Sir William Haselrig. Now, as word of these Scottish victories against the English rippled across Scotland, the men of the land rallied behind them, and the number on the battlefield grew significantly. The battle for Scottish independence was well underway. However, when news of the uprising reached Edward I, the King of England, known thereafter as Edward Hammer of the Scots, he was at the time across the Channel in France, and he ordered a troop of men to be sent north to deal with what he referred to as the Scottish problem. A Scotsman, holding the English title of Earl of Carrick, which was a small Scottish province in what is now South Ayrshire, was dispatched by Edward to lead a battalion to war for the English. The man's name was Robert the Bruce. Whilst travelling north to battle, Robert began to rethink his allegiances and decided that he must join with the people of his own land, of the land to which he was born, and did therefore switch sides to fight for the Scottish cause. Edward called again to the French, and he signed an agreement with them to form an alliance, which didn't, of course, include the Scots, thus breaking up this pre-existing French-Scottish alliance that had been prior. Edward returned to England, prepared to fight, and moved the seat of the government north from London to York in order to be closer to the face of the war. He led a great army into the Scottish lands, intent on crushing once and for all the last threads of Scottish resistance. William Wallace, who of course was made famous by that portrayal by Mel Gibson in the film Braveheart, met them on the battlefield at the Battle of Falkirk. But realistically, he never stood a chance against the English army, superior in virtually every way. Wallace's men were slaughtered, the longbowmen of the English army wiping out most of the Scottish cavalry from a great distance before the two forces even came to blows. Wallace himself survived the battle, but his credibility as a military leader had gone, and the rumour has it that he retreated into the thick woodlands nearby, near Falkirk, and resigned therein his guardianship of Scotland. However, this role of the guardian of the Kingdom of Scotland was soon filled by no other than the great Robert the Bruce. The war went on, and the Scottish, while fighting valiantly and ceaselessly for their independence, never truly stood much of a chance of winning the overall war, and in the years that followed, Robert the Bruce saw this imminent loss, and with his father ill and the Scottish throne never really going to be handed to him himself, he finally did give his allegiance over to Edward I and to the English crown. William Wallace, on the other hand, was captured and executed publicly in London. Scotland fell largely under English control. Robert the Bruce went into hiding. The English recaptured their castles and their land, and the war subsided. Albeit temporarily, of course. Edward died in 1307, and as was his request, his heart was carried to the Holy Land with the next Crusaders. The next February, in 1308, Edward's son, Edward II, ascended to the throne. He immediately married Isabella, the daughter of King Philip IV of France, in this great attempt to resolve the tensions between the English and the French. Edward was great friends with a man named Piers Galveston, 1st Earl of Cornwall, and in 1306 he had him knighted. Now, the nature of Edward's relationship with the Earl was quite unclear, and it's been the subject of many discussions and research by historians over time. Homosexuality was condemned fiercely by the Catholic Church, who equated it with the act of heresy. And so, clearly it was not something that one would want to admit to, and an allegation to be very clearly avoided where possible. The allegations of homosexuality would follow Edward II throughout his life, accused and engaging with sexual relationships with many different men over that time. But, of course, no concrete proof beyond written words would arise, or at least would not be allowed to arise for long. Edward was, regardless, married to Isabella of France, and they would indeed have 4 children together. Though the presence of Piers Galveston would hang over Edward's early reign like a shadow. He would provoke the barons in Parliament, calling them by offensive names, leading on numerous occasions to them refusing to attend the council should Galveston be there. He had a huge amount of assumed control over the land, and it was often said that, I quote, 2 kings ruled the land, one in word and one in deed. The barons hated the man, and petitioned the king over and over to elect a council, a parliament of senior barons, to advise on the important matters of the court. The king finally agreed, and a group of 21 barons was elected, known as the Ordainers, and they were split fairly evenly between reformers, who aimed to make changes to policy, and the conservatives, who did not. And this formed the beginning of this two-party parliament where voting would decide or at least advise on many important matters that the king and the country would face. The Ordainers began to draw together their reforms, known as their ordinances. Indeed, they were known as the Ordinances of 1311, which was the year. They included a clause, along with many, that would limit the king's ability to take the country to war without parliamentary approval, which would have huge ramifications in the years to come. In addition, the ordinances exiled Piers Galveston from the English realm, banishing him from the land and forbidding him from living anywhere on any of the king's land, which included at the time Gascony and Ireland as well. It's believed he left for France, or perhaps for Flanders in what is now Belgium. But the following year, in 1312, an angry Edward recalled Galveston to the kingdom once more, and the two met in York. A furious alliance of powerful barons led by the Earl of Lancaster had Galveston excommunicated from the church and captured him, taking him to Warwick Castle. After a brief trial, he was found guilty of being a traitor to the law and was executed on Blacklow Hill the following day. In 1315, huge rains fell across the continent. They were relentless through the winter, but then when spring came, they didn't stop, nor did the temperature rise much either, and the conditions persisted right through summer, right through autumn, and into that next winter as well. It caused the crops to fail, the grains didn't open, the fruit didn't ripen, and so the people fell hungry, and the hungry people fell starving. The straw and the hay that would have been used for the animals couldn't be cured in the warm, and the fallout from that was there was nothing to feed the livestock. The rains themselves flooded the land, especially in the lowlands of places like Yorkshire, Leicestershire, Nottinghamshire. The price for what food was left began to rise significantly as farmers and traders saw their incomes plummet. In those years before refrigeration, salt was used to cure the meat to allow it to be stored for longer, but salt came from allowing brine to evaporate, and this couldn't be done either in wet weather, so the meat couldn't even be stored for as long and of course began to spoil. Whilst many provisions were saved for the king and for the royals, throwing the peasantry into near starvation, King Edward found it difficult on occasion to find bread even for himself. It was reported that, and I quote, "a great famine of such mortality that the living could scarce suffice to bury the dead, that horse flesh and dog flesh were considered good meat, while some ate their own dead children." The continent fell apart as the rains fell through the year and right through the next. The animals which were going to be used for draft purposes, so the cart horses and the oxen used for pulling ploughs, were indeed eventually slaughtered for their meat. The seed grain was eaten, and in some places the children were simply left to fend for themselves. Indeed, side note, it's in this setting in Germany that the story of Hansel and Gretel was indeed set, the children living by themselves in the woodlands, that the woodcutter's children, trying to survive in times of extreme famine. It's estimated that up to a quarter of the country's population died. Once it was over, the nation spent years picking up the pieces. Edward's reputation in his parliament, amongst the barons of the land, was beginning to diminish too. He was still affording disproportionate amounts of power to certain favourites of his, as he had done with Piers Galveston. Though this time it was a man called Hugh Despenser the Younger, and by extension his family too, who were known as the Despensers. And there had been a civil war called the Despenser War, which had been fought between the crown and the barons. Then in 1325, with his wife Isabella, Edward's wife Isabella, beginning to hate him too, and taking his son, who would be Edward III eventually, away to France, she gathered the support of the French and a number of the people who'd previously been exiled by the king, and invaded her husband's country. This was certainly a rare event, the queen of a country invading her own land, and King Edward II was captured. A parliament was gathered to sit in his absence, and accusations were brought against the king for things such as promotion of his favourites, to the destruction of the church, and a betrayal of his oath as king. Edward's abdication was requested by the council, under the threat that should he not agree to hand the crown to his son, then it would indeed go to somebody outside of his own family, and so Edward II reluctantly agreed, and on the 1st of February that year, so that's 1327, a 14-year-old Edward III became the new king. Now, if we track back through the family tree slightly, we may recall that Isabella, Edward III's mother, was indeed the sister of Charles IV, the King of France. Now, when he died in 1329, Isabella laid claim to the vacant throne of France on behalf of her son, who would call himself the King of France and the French royal arms. The title was disputed, with the French much preferring the crown of France to sit on the head of a Frenchman, and the dispute went on for some time. And it wasn't until 1340, so that's 11 years later, that he was widely regarded as King of France. The French councils, however, saw this otherwise, and the dispute would lead into what became known as the Hundred Years' War, a conflict that would indeed last 116 years in total. The rivaling armies of the English and the French embarked on a series of battles and small wars over the ensuing years, many fought out across the northern portions of France in places like Cannes and Calais. Indeed, Calais would remain under English control until long after the end of the war. This allowed the English to get their troops back and forth across the Channel without much incident, with Calais as this strategic landing port. Now, another massive event of the 1300s, indeed of all time, occurred in 1348, or likely a few years earlier. Sweeping in from Eastern Europe and Asia was a vast pandemic of bubonic plague, the likes the world has never seen before and has not seen since. Known as the Black Death, the Pestilence, the Plague, or sometimes the Great Mortality, it's by far the most fatal pandemic in human history. Brought by fleas on black rats, it killed up to 200 million people across Eurasia. In 1349, it killed half the population of London, and is thought by the time it passed in 1355 to have wiped out anywhere from 30 even to 60% of the population of the continent. The population, which had grown steadily over the centuries, of course fell considerably. And in fact, it fell so significantly that it wouldn't get back to those pre-Black Death levels for nearly another 200 years. After the plague had passed, again the country, and indeed the whole world more or less, was left wilted in its wake. Now Edward III's son, also called Edward, though he was never king, so he's without a number in this context, indeed he was Prince of Wales, was given command of the armies of England. He would go on to be known as the Black Prince due to his black armour on the battlefield. The Black Prince routed the cities in France. Avignonnet, Castelnaudard, Narbonne, Auvergne, Limousin, Berry, all sacked and ravaged by this marauding English prince and his forces. At the Battle of Poitiers in 1356, they faced off a French force on the battlefield, with a mounted unit of horsemen laying in ambush in the nearby woodlands. When the French turned to retreat, they were cut off by the riders and the French force was massacred. The ruling King John of France was captured by the English, and the French organisation fell apart, descending into chaos. There's a great quote from the Chronicles of Jean de Vannet, which reads, I quote, "All went ill with the kingdom, and the state was undone. Thieves and robbers rose up everywhere in the land. The nobles despised and hated all others, and took no thought for usefulness and profit of lord and men. They subjected and despoiled the peasants and the men of the villages. In no wise did they defend their country from its enemies. Rather did they trample it underfoot, robbing and pillaging the peasants' goods." Edward besieged Reims for 5 weeks, eventually switching his attentions to Paris in order to capture the crown. But when a freak severe hailstorm fell on what would go on to be known as Black Monday, wiping out more than 1,000 English soldiers, which was more than at any battle of the war, Edward was forced to negotiate with the French. With King John of France captured, an agreement for peace was brokered, and despite his initial release in exchange for the captivity of a number of other figures, which included his own sons, John would indeed return himself to captivity, and there he would die in 1364. Now, in great contrast to Edward I and Edward II, who'd spent most of their reign in conflict with the barons, with the ruling classes, with their own peerage, Edward III successfully created a great relationship with them, and one of camaraderie. He created more peers, he created the title of Duke and the chivalric Order of the Garter, which is still in use today, some 673 years later. It's the most senior order of knighthood in Britain, only outranked in the honours system by the George Cross and the Victoria Cross. The reinforcement of the aristocracy, the newfound sense of English pride, was further bolstered by the imminent threat of invasion from the French. This strengthened this unity of the people. There was a concern that should the French invasion be successful, they would wipe out the English language, and Edward made the most of this. The English language saw this great revival at this time, indeed somewhat of an overhaul. It was ordered that the courts should only use the English language from then on, and we see the beginning of some of the great works of English language, indeed of the Middle English period, with people like John Gower and Geoffrey Chaucer, whose works, The Canterbury Tales, would cement his place in literary history. Indeed, he's often regarded as the grandfather of English literature. Books, however, were incredibly expensive at the time, and the printing press was yet to be invented in 1440, and books were often encrusted with jewels to signify their owner's wealth. Music was also a part of life, especially in the church. And we see some of the great medieval composers appearing too at this time, with pieces like the Mass de Notre Dame, the Mass of Our Lady by de Machaut, which is widely regarded as one of the finest masterpieces of the medieval period, composed in 1365, so this exact time. In 1369, the war indeed did start again, still regarded here as the Hundred Years' War. And within a few years, an elderly and increasingly infirm Edward III was delegating much of his power to his sons and to certain others, and in 1376, Edward developed a large abscess, and the following year, in 1377, died. He was succeeded by his 10-year-old grandson, Richard, who would be known as King Richard II of England. Richard's two uncles, John of Gaunt and Edward of Woodstock, ran most of the operations of the crown with the assistance of the Parliament and this series of regency councils. In 1381, on the back of decades of strife for the English people, going back to the awful aftereffects of the Black Death, the high taxes that had been imposed to fund the constant war with France, and this new instability in leadership, we saw an uprising which was to be known as the Peasants' Revolt. Rural farmers, town mayors, civil leaders, village officials rose up in protest, burning court records and opening up the jails, freeing the prisoners locked inside. A 14-year-old King Richard at this time locked himself up in the Tower of London in fear as the stampeding rioters stormed London. Led by Wat Tyler, they attacked the jails, destroyed the Savoy Palace and the Temple Church, burned records, and killed anyone they saw as associated with the government. They entered the Tower and killed the Lord Chancellor and the Lord High Treasurer. The King had no choice but to meet their demands. The revolt spread north as far as York and Scarborough, and as far east as Bridgewater in Somerset. The Peasants' Revolt drastically changed the tide, though, of the Hundred Years' War. Until then, the war had been funded in large part by these taxes, and with these taxes now agreed by the king to be lowered, the funds for battle were not at all what they'd been, and not at all what they needed to be to continue the war the way it had been. The Parliament agreed that war in France should be carefully scaled back, and that options for a peace negotiation should be explored. By the end of the century, as we get into the 1390s here, we enter a time known to historians as the tyranny of King Richard. For little reason, though some speculate as revenge for earlier indiscretions, Richard had a number of the leading earls arrested, imprisoned, some executed, and others exiled from the lands for life. He carried out these moves in conjunction with a small band of powerful friends who he rewarded with new titles. So some were made earls, some of the existing earls were made dukes, which was, as I said, this new title that he created. In 1399, Louis I gained control of the court from a rather insane King Philip IV of France and allowed a young Henry Bolingbroke, who was Edward's cousin and whose father was John of Gaunt, to return to England. Henry travelled south from where he landed in Ravenspurn in Yorkshire. This, the town no longer exists. It's close to where Kingston-upon-Hull is today, amassing great support behind him as he went. The king was over in Ireland at the time with most of his knights and many of the loyal members of his nobility, and so there was no real resistance there to stop Henry from advancing. When Richard did return to England, he met his cousin at Flint Castle and agreed to abdicate from the throne in exchange for his life, and the two men rode back to London, one behind the other. It was deemed that Richard, through his tyranny and misgovernment, was unworthy to continue as king. A gathering of the lords and the commons declared as such, and on the 13th of October 1399, just weeks before the end of the century, Henry Bolingbroke would be crowned Henry IV, King of England. Next time, we explore the 1400s, the Battle of Agincourt, the War of the Roses, the founding of Eton, King's College and All Souls, and Richard III, last of the Plantagenet kings.